been granted a political asylum by Ecuador, but concerned if he steps foot outside the embassy in order to get to Ecuador, he'll be arrested by British authorities. On Wednesday, part two of our interview with Julian Assange. Special thanks to Mike Burke, John Hamilton, and Dennis Moynihan. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Has job openings. We're have a job opening for administrative director, as well as a Linux systems administrator and fall internships. Visit democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley, as well as Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Besta Gudars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Carla De Jesus, and Phil Raymond. Again, our website is democracynow.org. You can watch, listen to, and read all of our interviews with Julian Assange, as well as on all of our shows. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with our host, Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora.
You put a big black blob in the middle of Canada, and you reach out a tentacle to every part of the coast. There's a giant octopus that's essentially wrapping its tentacles around North America.
I find it marvelous how people can somehow drive down a 18-lane freeway in their SUV, cursing and swearing about products of the oil sands coming to California. As Pogo said, we've seen the enemy, and he is us.
This Monday, July 7th, Locus Focus presents a special presentation of a new documentary by Barbara Bernstein. Fighting Goliath is a story about the frenetic exploitation of the Canadian tar sands and its rippling effects across the continent. Tune in on Monday, July 7th from 10 to 11 a.m. to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or listen online at kboo.fm.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, at Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You should. Good morning. That was Nina Simone in her song, Young, Gifted, and Black. You are listening to KBOO FM 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, 90.7 in Portland, and KBOO.FM via the World Wide Web. This is More Talk Radio. This is Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday, July 7th, 2014. Today, our guest is Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora, published by NYU Press. Professor Redman is Assistant Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Professor Redman, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so glad that you are able to join us. Your book has been met with praise in many circles. And in this book, I think you are able to inform and transform our understanding of what we think we may know about the songs and the movements that they are associated with. One reviewer, in speaking about your book, praised you this way. He said, Dr. Shauna Redman takes the interdisciplinary mantle back in breaking tremendous ground and in highlighting diasporic histories to the transformative possibilities of the sonic and the role of music in the formation of imagined and real communities, all while demonstrating what interdisciplinary work looks like and the amazing work that can be done through a true embrace of an interdisciplinary praxis. Dr. Redman delivers a book that is a game changer. You're quite a person, and you've done quite a feat. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your background, and that maybe that explains how you're able to write such a very creative book.
Well, thank you for that compliment and for reading that piece. The book, I'm so glad to hear, is doing the work that I hoped it would do. And the project grew out of my kind of particular interests in music and performance. I was myself a singer at one point, particularly in college. Music was one of my majors, and I was a vocalist as my instrument. But then also my investments, which also matured in college around social justice movements. I was very involved in college. I went to McAllister College in St. Paul, and I'm a Midwesterner. And my kind of college development was heavily informed by the kind of politics and struggles of organized labor in particular. And so when I decided that I was going to look to graduate school and look to the academy as my industry, I wanted to figure out how to develop a project that would actually be able to merge my two most kind of profound investments, and those were in social justice and music making. And thankfully, after doing some research in the archives and thinking more deeply about those intersections, I came across actually the correspondence that laid the foundation for Chapter 2, which is around the anthem of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so the project really grew from the exchange that I found there in the archives. And the work of the project then, in trying to talk about music making as a political practice, kind of exploded from there. And I was able to use some of my previous training as a music scholar by incorporating music theory and sheet music analysis, but also pay closer attention to the dynamics of political exchange on a transnational scale. And so this project ended up just being this unique alchemy of what I was already invested in intellectually and politically, but also really challenging me to think differently about how we understand community, how we understand ourselves as individuals within those formations, and then how the nation also functioned in people's exchanges and racial formations.
As you began this project and delve deeper into the library, and I can imagine that perhaps you might have ended up in a different place than you thought. Share a little bit about that experience of exploring and discovering new things.
Absolutely. I actually went into this project thinking that it was going to be very contemporary, so that it was going to end up being focused in the late 20th century and early 21st. And as I mentioned, my initial engagement with the question of the anthem as a genre within the African diaspora developed from this chapter two element, which is really focused on the Depression moment. Mm-hmm. And as I was encouraged to think about a genealogy of anthem making amongst the African descended, I necessarily needed to go back as well as to come forward in the 20th century. And so thinking about the NAACP within the literatures on Black social movements, and in particular the literatures of Black movements in the early 20th century, you really have to wrestle with Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And so the book really begins in this immediate post-World War I moment with the UNIA, with Marcus Garvey, and with their anthem. And as far as archival work is concerned, it took quite a bit of effort to get to the music for the UNIA anthem, which is entitled Ethiopia, the Land of Our Fathers. I was contacting scholars across the country who were experts in Garvey, experts in the movement, and they had little to no knowledge of the anthem other than having seen it mentioned or documented in organizational records. And so doing the work of finding the sheet music so that I could do some close analysis and close readings of it was quite a task, but it was actually really interesting to kind of move throughout the U.S. and even the Caribbean in my conversations with archivists in the Caribbean to try and find this information. So doing that archival work definitely gave me a whole new appreciation for the process of intellectual work, for the process of archival work, but also for the labors of the archivists and librarians themselves. But it also, as I mentioned, pushed my timeline significantly farther back in the 20th century. And ultimately, I'm really thankful for that because it does give more of a solid foundation for thinking through how music developed as a political strategy for the African descended, and pinpoints this really important, pivotal moment in the development of kind of a modern citizenship at the end of World War I.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. Later on, we invite your calls if you have questions or comments for Professor Redman. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. So perhaps we should begin by talking about the music that you write about in this book, Professor Redman. Now, you mentioned about the search for the music around Ethiopia, Land of Our Fathers, which is associated with the Marcus Garvey and UNIA. Now, certainly, I think many of us know about Marcus Garvey, but perhaps not as much. But one thing I think that perhaps I would ask is in terms of that movement seems to me at least to be not merely a political movement, but also a cultural movement. So certainly you had the song, the anthem you write about, but also there was the economic, there was the political, there was even the, you know, formation of a religious sect associated with that. Tell us a little bit about Ethiopia, thou land of our father. Why was it difficult to find the music?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's a question that's still a bit unclear to me why that particular piece of the organization was so difficult to locate, because as you mentioned, this was a richly, densely cultural organization, and really picked up on the already seeded elements of Black cultural nationalism that developed in the late 19th century and kind of grew it to new heights and made it explosive on the social scene in the United States, but also throughout the world, with particular density in the Caribbean. So the UNIA absolutely set new standards for what culture would mean within social movement mobilizations and what it could do in the thinking of marginalized groups around political change and political advance. It was a highly stylized organization with military units, religious units, separate units for women, the Black Cross nurses, and other types of opportunities, and everyone had their particular role to play within the Black nation, as Marcus Garvey called it. And in their nation building, some of the most important symbols of any nation, right, is a flag, which mm-hmm. Marcus Garvey developed, the Black, red, and green flag. That we still see present today in different moments and communities. But then also, in addition to a flag, a nation has an anthem. And so looking for and trying to investigate this anthem was, unbeknownst to me, quite a unique endeavor. I didn't actually expect it to be so difficult to locate this music. And what I ultimately found ended up coming out of the personal collection of an archivist at Emory University in Atlanta named Randall Burkett, who himself was a Garvey scholar. And so I'm really thankful for having done the work of just reaching out to people randomly, having conversations with folks, and it ended up being a bit of telephone or, you know, a trail that I would speak to someone who would put me in touch with someone else. And it ended up working out well. But I think that the lack of attention paid to the music of the movement is really telling in some striking ways. I think that people have been so mesmerized by the visual elements mm-hmm. of the UNIA and Marcus Garvey that they've forgotten all of the sonic elements that additionally made possible the movement that we know today. And so I really wanted to get back to those types of maneuvers and strategies, back to those kind of everyday exchanges that may not have looked as fantastic, but nonetheless were absolutely central to the structure of the organization. This anthem was played documented within the laws of the UNIA. It was demanded that it be played at certain moments during any UNIA gathering, whether it was a fantastic national convention or whether it was a very small local branch performance and ceremony. It was demanded that it be played. And so I wanted to try and understand with this anthem and others of them within the book, why? What difference did this make? How did people engage it? What did it sound like? What difference did it make in people's political thinking? And this anthem really set a really important tone for the entire book as the first chapter in thinking about why sound actually made a difference to the way that African descended people understood their political possibility in the 20th century.
We're speaking with Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sounds of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. I was left in wonder as you completed that last statement in terms of the role and the importance of sound in the movement, and certainly it sets the tone for the whole book. And a reminder, I think a failure that many of us fall into is try to analyze social and political movements apart from the cultural element. So we might spend a lot of time looking at speeches and political stratagem, but ignore the role that other cultural parts play in movement building in many ways. So thank you for noting that and directing our attention to the importance of those cultural pieces in learning about movements.
Absolutely.
Maybe just one final question on Ethiopia, the land of our fathers. You mentioned that it was expected to be played and sung at certain parts, events around UNIA. Tell us a little bit about the music itself, who authored it, and what type of music, what type of anthem, the purpose of it, why did people, what was the expectations from singing the music?
Sure. So one of the interesting things about Marcus Garvey as kind of the figurehead and organizer of the UNIA is that as invested as he was in documenting the unique histories and strengths of the African descended, actually his choice in music was very much invested in Western art traditions,
yes,
in more Eurocentric hymn traditions and classical music traditions. He employed a series of scholars of music as well as musicians who did the work of explaining and composing for the organization the reasons why African-descended people needed to adopt particular types of sonic cultures. And so, for example, his band leader, William Iles, used the Negro World, which was their newspaper, to talk about why it was important that we look to Europe to gain much of our musical traditions. They actually used the newspaper to lambast blues culture, which was prominent at the rise of the UNIA in the 1920s, and to really make peripheral different types of Black American formations of music like jazz as well. And so it was interesting to me to then come across the sheet music. And the sheet music for this song was so crucial because I still to this day have never found a recording of this anthem, which is the only anthem in the book that I've not been able to document a live recording of. And so the sheet music was particularly significant for this chapter. But in finding it and doing some analysis of it, being able to play it myself, it was very clear that it followed in their kind of literary references to music making and what Black music making should be. It was written in four-part harmonies, very closely aligned with the hymn traditions of Western Europe. And it was co-authored by two Caribbean-descended members of the UNIA in New York City, Benjamin Burrell and Rabbi Arnold Ford, who was a Black Israelite. And they co-authored the lyrics, and then Rabbi Ford composed the music for the anthem. And this happened around 1916, so before kind of the fantastic launch of the UNIA, but at the moment at which it was gaining a national prominence in the United States. And the lyrics of it, it very much extol the virtues of Ethiopia and in some ways romanticize it. Ethiopia as this location that had not yet been colonized at that moment, was one of the last bastions of African independence, and was very much focused on this location that was kind of the bed of civilization. Ethiopia, thou land of our fathers, thou land where the gods love to be, is the first line of the anthem, and goes on to talk about how the UNIA's military forces will defend Ethiopia at all costs. And this is a part of Marcus Garvey's kind of back to Africa philosophy,
yes,
that ended up becoming more rhetoric than reality. He himself never went to Africa. They were not successful in repatriating African descended peoples to the continent. but was very much a part of the language of the organization and prominent within the anthem itself. Mm-hmm. And so this four-part harmony very much mimics the European model, but part of what I do in looking closely at the music is to try and find those moments of fissure. And so in this anthem, as in many of the others that follow within the book, there is this moment of departure in which the men begin to advance the line, "Let Africa be free." And they advance that language of kind of a militaristic intervention without the women. There's a break, and the men lead that line with the women following after. And it's those moments for me that really signal a lot of the internal politics of the organization, right? That men are the ones who are imagined to advance the cause of the race, to militaristically intervene when there are moments of compromise, and that the women are expected to fall in line, but at a later date after the men's leadership has been established. And so I try and take those moments and expand them out to think about some of the problems within these organizations, yes, some of the ways in which they themselves are duplicating the problems of gender, the problems of class, nation, sexuality at any given time within their own function, even as they have these fantastic, important political interventions to make within a national and diasporic scene.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott here on KBOO FM. We're speaking with Professor Shauna Redmond, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. All numbers here are 503-231-8187, and you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. I want to pause at that last comment and jump over a few decades, and because I think it's important to talk about a song that we think we all know, but we discovered, you help us to discover a lot more about it, particularly its history. We Shall Overcome. So, you know, many of us, our eyes begin to roll when we ever hear that song. But what we discover in your book is the fascinating history of that song. So many of us associated with civil rights movements in the 60s, Dr. King marching. But there is so much more about that song. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. That song, actually, of them all, was the one when I was doing the research for the book that I was least excited to investigate, in
yes,
part because I, too, believed that I knew that story, mm-hmm, that it was very clear to us all. We've heard it again and again and again. It's been canonized in very particular types of ways, and I didn't think that there was too much more for me to find there, but I was pleasantly surprised in doing the research for it that pleasantly surprised and a bit disappointed that I actually didn't know the story at all. Mm-hmm. That the song actually comes to prominence as a political ballad almost 20 years earlier than what we expect to understand of its periodization. So it develops in the mid-1940s as in 1945 as a labor ballad in Charleston, and is the language used by black women tobacco workers to actually boost their spirits whilst on strike with the Food, Tobacco, and Agricultural Union, Local 15. And it was really an eye-opening moment for me to have done the work of that chapter, because it not only moves the periodization for that song, but also it was really important for me to know that it grew out of a labor struggle and with a union that actually was ahead of its time in certain respects. It was a CIO union, a Congress of Industrial Organizations union, and it was interracial. Now, considering that it was within the South, it still, mm-hmm, had its own kind of segregated ranks right? It was an integrated union technically in that they organized both black and white workers in this moment. But when they walked the picket line, they walked in segregated pickets. And things were, by and large, within the workspace itself, separate, that women had to do a very particular type of work. Black women had to do a very particular type of work. Some of the messiest, dirtiest elements of the work, and were segregated from the white women workers, who quite often were working in the more mechanized areas of the industry, of the plant. And that black women used this song on their picket lines during that ill-fated strike really signaled to me the ways in which we should always understand the civil rights genealogies and histories that we learn as heavily invested in questions of labor and class. And so I think that the anthem really gives us some important insights into why people chose that song and what difference it makes, because all of that history is already embedded in the song. When people like MLK are singing that song, it carries with it all of these labor histories, and I think that's important to keep in mind.
How did it move from the women union movement in the South, and how did it become adapted by the civil rights movement in the 60s?
So the song became kind of the calling card for that particular strike, and it developed this strike developed in the moment of the rise of Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. And Tennessee, the Highlander School was doing work to make sure that, in particular, labor struggles within the U.S. South had the opportunity to document themselves, to come into conversation with other labor struggles in the South, and to develop different types of strategies in responding to the oppressive conditions of wage labor. And so they would have these in-services or workshops for workers in particular industries, where workers would come together at the Highlander Center, and they would do workshops together. They would share strategies from within similar industries. And so the FTA, the union from Charleston of these tobacco workers, held an in-service at Highlander in 1947 and brought together workers from Memphis, from Charleston, from other of the sites of the FTA industry, and they developed different types of strategies for responding to labor unrest, for developing labor unrest on behalf of the workers, and shared a lot of songs, did a lot of drama, as was kind of the distinguishing marker of the Highlander School, really investing in culture as a way to build worker solidarities. And so different members from each of these locals came together, and the song was shared there in 1947, and it's still a little unclear who the representatives of the Charleston local were in that space, but it's clear that the song was taught there in its bits and pieces, what people could recall, because, you know, protest is a living activity. Things were not documented word for word, and so there were some things that were shared there that may have ad-libbed a bit on what happened in the streets in Charleston. While at Highlander, Zofia Horton, the partner of Miles Horton and musician, took the song, developed a real liking to it. Miles describes that it was her favorite song ever, and began to teach it and retool it with the assistance of people like Pete Seeger, who entered the scene a few years later, and used that as one of the distinguishing songs of the Highlander School, and began to teach it to workers. So at that moment, it was really being carried by word of mouth and at a very local scale. But as the civil rights movement begins to mount on a national scale, more workers are coming in, civil rights activists are coming in, sharing space at the Highlander Center. But also the workers are going back out into the world, not just into their locals, but into different spaces of strategy with workers within their industries. Civil rights workers are also leaving Highlander, going out into the world. And so the anthem really is a perfect example of the word of mouth element, the oral traditions that have carried so much of black music making, because it is first and foremost an oral tradition rather than a literate tradition. People are free to ad lib, to adjust the words. So we shall overcome. The use of the word shall is something that happened at the Highlander School. It was not a part of the original language. It was we will overcome when it was coming from Charleston. There are all of these ways in which the language begins to change as it's carried through different communities and struggles. And so that was the original genealogy for the piece.
That's a fascinating history and a reminder of in terms of the cultural piece, how it's living and breathing, and embedded in that song is maybe the memory of its origin. So, you know, even as people sang it in the 60s and sometimes we associated with civil rights, embedded in it is the vision for economic rights. So even the 63 March on Washington, which we often think about as a march for civil rights, a part of that theme was economics and jobs and opportunity. So I think as we remember and we sing these songs, somehow maybe the inner meaning of these songs begin to rise up and maybe help form us in many different ways.
Absolutely. And I think it is really important to recognize that these are layering effects that happen, that new political circumstances absolutely grow out of these older formations, and that in sharing those strategies, we are building on those previous histories, carrying some of that energy with us.
We're speaking with Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sounds of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. Are there music or songs that are important to you in your movement building? Join us and share. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. You may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Now I'm going to jump back a few decades, because as you were talking about that and the origins of We Shall Overcome, and how its genesis was in the labor movement, I was thinking about how songs which may or may not have any outwardly initially political meaning come to take on a power that maybe its authors did not think in the beginning. So I want to go back to Paul Robeson and Old Man River. How did he take that song that was associated with a Broadway musical and transform it to give it so much more power than I think its original authors thought it might have?
Sure. So this song was written in 1927, and it was written as a part of, or kind of the lead song within the musical Showboat, and was written with Robeson in mind, actually. Jerome Kern, who was the lyrics author for the song, had Robeson in mind when he was writing this song, wanted him to play this character of Joe. And ultimately, Robeson passed on the first run of the show as it was being developed on Broadway, as it grew into a hit with the baritone Jules Bledsoe in the role, but began to play the role when it moved to London. And while in London, Robeson had already built a reputation for himself, had already become this fantastic presence on art stages within the United States, and continued to develop his craft on stage in Europe while performing in the role, but decided to continue to perform this song in his individual sets, recognizing that it had garnered him an even greater amount of attention by performing this role in the musical, and incorporated it into his individual concert sets, which were at this time composed primarily of Negro spirituals. And it's a really interesting scene because this song kind of fits very uneasily within that repertoire of Negro spirituals. It was certainly intended to kind of mimic the style of Negro spirituals, but was not itself of that kind of tradition. And so as Robeson performed it, he was also in Europe studying at the London School of Economics, studying with different community groups, different communities that were investing very heavily in two particular issues. One in labor, organized labor, working very closely with dock workers in particular, working in Wales and Liverpool, many of whom were African workers who had come to the metropole through the seafaring industries to work on the docks, and he developed deep, mature relationships with those workers. And then relatedly, because so many of those workers were African, he also began to invest very significantly in the organizing around decolonization. And so while in Europe, he argues in his autobiography that he developed kind of an awakening, a political awakening, and decided in that moment that he needed to use his artwork to actually demonstrate not only the riches of these traditions, these musical traditions grown from the African descended, but also to have the arts attached to very particular types of political movements and ideologies, and that he himself needed to be invested in understanding them, in speaking publicly about them, and using his platform of the concert stage as one of his speech methods in furthering those movements. So labor, decolonization, and ultimately peace end up becoming kind of his three major platforms in his political work. And Old Man River, recognizing how much attention it had garnered for him, that it helped to make his reputation, particularly in Europe, he slowly, through his study and political work, begins to change the song. So he begins performing it in 1928, and in that version, they're still using the N-word as a word to describe African-descended workers, that N-words all work on the Mississippi, N-words work while the white folks play, is the language of the original. Slowly over time, as different types of political movements develop, in response to this type of language, in response to treatment of African-descended peoples, it transitions from the N-word to colored, et cetera, et cetera. But part of the work of the song is really as a lament for the black worker, right? Mm-hmm. That he's really kind of beaten down by his position, that he's given up on the world, and Robeson revamps all of that language and says, there's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man I don't like to be, that he doesn't want to kind of lament the world and concede defeat in the face of all of the powers that be they racial oppression, labor oppression, regional oppressions. He says this is not who he wants to be, that I'm going to keep fighting until I'm dying is the very last end of the song. And this is something that changes over time. He performs the song for almost 40 years. And slowly changing all of these lyrics over time. And there's a documented kind of genealogy for these changes as concert reviewers begin to notice, oh, he changed that word there. He has an anti-war lyric there. And it's really amazing to see the change over time because you can track his political consciousness and its development through the changes that he made to this song, as well as where he performed it during his concerts. Sometimes it wasn't on the concert program at all, that it was his encore, his final statement for the evening. And in those moments, it's really important to recognize what type of language he's using, because it does a lot of work for him making his imprint politically in those moments.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sounds of Solidarity in the African Diaspora, published by NYU Press. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And we'll go to Neil. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning. Welcome, Ms. Redman. My comment is about one of the most beautiful shows about African music that has ever been on. It was developed by Bernice Johnson Regan. It was called Wade in the Water and was on KBOO and on OPB about 20 years ago. It was about a 20-part show, I believe, and I managed to record six, and they're some of my prized possessions. She went back into African-American a cappella music and would focus the show on Chicago, Birmingham, Los Angeles, that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering if Miss Redmond has heard of that or has any comments about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I wasn't familiar with the program itself, so that, thank you. That's something that I would definitely like to investigate and hopefully be able to find the entire collection somewhere. But I am quite familiar with Bernice Johnson Regan. She is really prominent as a thinker, theorist, and historian in my chapter on We Shall Overcome, in part because her dissertation actually began to tackle the genealogy of the song, locating its roots in the Sea Islands off of South Carolina, and developing through oral histories its relationship to organized labor in South Carolina. So she's been incredibly pivotal in my thinking around that song. And then I've also followed as a fan of her solo performances as well as her work with the African-American women's a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Mm-hmm. And I've written a bit about some of their political work as well. I think she's just an incredible talent and thinker and has been super important to how I understand Black music. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Neil, for sharing. We're speaking with Shauna Redmond, author of Anthems, Social Movements, and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. When Neil mentioned Bernice Regan, it brought to my mind someone else that you write about in this book. And we began the program this morning, Nina Simone, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. Now, as a song we haven't spoken about yet, Lift Every Voice and Sing, is associated with the NAACP. Nina Simone, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, is associated with the Core of Congress for Racial Equality. Tell us about that and what was happening in the 60s, and how did that song by Nina Simone take on a life and importance?
Yeah, so that story is really fascinating, too. I love the story of how this anthem came to be. So Nina Simone is an artist who really developed her political awakening in concert, literally, with other thinkers and activists of this period, namely James Baldwin, the novelist, essayist, and brilliant mind, as well as Lorraine Hansberry, who was, of course, a playwright, author, essayist herself. And in the early 1960s, they develop a tight relationship, the three of them, but specifically Lorraine and Nina develop a really intense relationship. And Nina talks about in her autobiography that they developed a bond as women that was not just girls talk about shopping and men, but it was real girls talk, she described it, real girls talk, which was about revolution and Marx. And it was Lorraine Hansberry who really challenged Nina to think about herself not only as a Black person, but as a Black woman in a world run by men. And so she, from there on out, begins to develop a repertoire that speaks back to these conditions of difference. So beginning with Mississippi Goddamn, 1964, and this is after Lorraine's passing. And so yes, Lorraine Hansberry dies very early, far too early, of cancer in 1963. And Nina kind of travels throughout the 1960s with Lorraine by her side, that she's influencing all of these political pieces that develop. And by 1968, there has been the posthumous release of Hansberry's play, which is entitled To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, which is a piece that she had begun prior to her passing, had in bits and pieces all over the place, but was compiled by her ex-husband and literary executor, Robert Nemiroff, in 1968 to go on tour. And the tour was funded primarily through the efforts of Harry Belafonte. And so the play goes on tour. It has a off-Broadway run. And it's from this moment of kind of a heightened engagement with a new formation of blackness, kind of the black is beautiful moment of rearticulated pride. It's also growing alongside a more militarized nationalist wing of the black liberation movement, most kind of spectacularly epitomized by the Black Panther Party, that Nina sees the play and writes a song entitled To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, and begins to perform it around the world. And by 1971, CORE has kind of reoriented itself more towards this cultural nationalist, this militarized nationalist bent, after having begun in the 1940s under James Farmer as a more kind of integrationist organization. And they decide that no longer is the Negro national anthem of Lift Every Voice and Sing adequate. They now demand a black national anthem, and that black national anthem should be Nina Simone's To Be Young, Gifted, and Black.
We're speaking with Shauna Redmond, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sounds of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and our engineer Steve, who is always right on top of things, posted a link to the song that Neil, to the program Neil mentioned on my Facebook page, Wade in the Water. It's NPR, so you can go to NPR to find that. Find that program, Bernice Reagan, Wade in the Water. But in the meantime, we're speaking with Shauna Redmond, author of a fascinating volume that helps us to understand the movement and the movements, music and the movement. Let's go to our next caller. LJ, good morning. LJ?
I'm right here.
Yes, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Great.
Good. Thank you for the show. I got to tell you how so-called African music impacted my life. I'm a product of the 50s, all right? And there's this music that started to come on the radio called rhythm and blues, which was essentially Afro-American music that was played on black radio stations that found its way into into the white culture. And and we discovered rock and roll. It became rock and roll, right? And for me, I was a little. I was a Jewish kid raised in the Bronx, and we used to go to the Apollo Theater in Harlem, stand on line with Afro Americans to get to see the shows. And I was exposed to a culture that I never even knew existed. I'll never forget seeing Pigmeat Markham on stage at the Apollo, and exposed to a comedy thing that I never even knew about. And so I certainly will take my reactions to that off the air. And thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. LJ mentioned in terms of the importance for his own personal development, the music and the culture of African Americans. As we look to the future, and you address it somewhat in your book. So I'll ask the question: where do we go from here? Do you sense there is a continuing link between movement and music? at one point in time, many of us thought that hip hop would take on that banner. What do you see as the future, and where should we look for the linkage between movement and music?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that that a future of anthem making is imminently available to us. It just takes the creative energy and the investment in linking that creative energy with people's struggles. I think that hip-hop does have the potential to do that. I think that hip-hop has done that work. I think, so I asked the book in the conclusion and the brief discussion of Fight the Power of the Public Enemy, which we're celebrating this year in relation to the
Spike Lee's movie.
Spike Lee's film, exactly, mm-hmm. Do the Right Thing. And I think that this particular moment, these anniversaries give us a moment again to kind of reflect on, well, what work did this song do? What difference did it make? And what types of futures might it make available? And I do think that it sets a really important tone as at the close of the 20th century for thinking about what new musical formations could do, formations that still at the moment of 1989 were undervalued, were demonized, and continue in some respects to be demonized as a genre, right? That is solely materialistic or not in line with the most kind of valued of our beliefs and ethics. And I just don't think that's true. I think that there are opportunities there for people to really focus their energies and to bring into communion different types of communities and political strategies to move forward new struggles, particularly as we're looking at continued economic concerns, underemployment, unemployment, particularly for of color communities, that there are ways in which we can look to these strategies as opportunities for new movement building. And I think most specifically, it's important to look at the very local level, that we are not going to find our next national or transnational anthem necessarily fully formed and prepackaged as such. We really need to pay close and focused attention at the local level and to think about how are different communities mobilizing their energies and resources? How are they responding back to these conditions that they face very specifically, but that in some part all of us experience in our day-to-day lives? And so what I encourage folks to do is to really pay close attention to the local.
Excellent.
Because that's where our next anthem is going to develop. That's where we're going to continue to find the strategies that will make a different future possible.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Redman, for joining us this morning. Again, we've been speaking with Shauna Redman, author of Anthem, Social Movements, and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora, published by NYU Press. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And you are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour.
Former Governor Jeb Bush speaking to the American Legislative Exchange Council in August 2013.
America has become a global leader in education spending while also becoming a global laggard in math and science. In 1993, ALEC demonstrated that we cannot buy student achievement from unaccountable government bureaucracies.
How ALEC has chosen to deal with those government bureaucracies is to submit model legislation to state legislatures like the Virtual Public Schools Act, which would give online schools like the Oregon Connection Academy the same resources and funding as public schools. With that is the potential of millions of dollars diverted from public schools while putting children's academic records in the hands of corporations. How has this happened and why? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KBOO's investigative news team on the effort to privatize education in Oregon on Monday, July 7th at 5:45, right after the evening news.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I am Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour on today, July 7th, 2014. As moles, we agitate and educate around values, methods, visions, and above all, possibilities for a sustainable, just, peaceful, and participatory world. We do this as radio activists with interviews, music, commentary, movie and book reviews, and readings. But we also aim to embolden your sense of agency as conscious parts of big things, collective struggles against systemic forms of oppression that, in the words of the old hymnal, we shall overcome. On today's show, Lori Mercier and her guest Peter Hart discuss how mainstream news media has covered the Iraq war and whose interests this coverage has served. After that, Bill Resnick talks with Arun Gupta about how Seattle passed a $15 minimum wage, what's next, and what that does or doesn't mean about a resurgent labor movement. Later in the show, Ivan Hale offers the personal is political commentary on same-sex intimate partner violence. And to wrap up the show, Well Read Red, Clayton Morgeridge reads and comments on a Jacobin article by